My research field is medieval Christian Europe and not recent Islamic Turkey. But when on May 13th in 2014 a mine accident took place in Turkish Soma, an eyewitness tragically reminded me on the topicality of my research question. The horrible disaster was determined by fate, this witness said, and like everyone around, he absolutely believed in fate. But nevertheless, he wished nothing more than that the responsible persons get caught and punished. This statement shows clearly the tension between the belief in the power of fate or destiny, fortune, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the responsibility of men for their actions and decisions to shape everybody's own fate, to influence and to change the future. This sets up the basis for my investigations. I'm still far away from finishing my research project, so many things, of course, have to remain provisional. For now, I split my paper into three parts. In the next about 40 minutes, I'd like to develop the most important questions of my research at first. Secondly, I'll give a short explanation of the methods I use and the selection of my sources. And at last, I'd like to give some first results, or rather first thoughts, regarding one of my chosen examples, the already mentioned Irish Collectio Hibernensis, written in the first half of the 8th century. Part 1. Franz Tinnefeld, a scholar in Byzantine studies, has pointed out that every culture worshipping a divine power raised two fundamental questions. Nämlich erstens die Frage nach dem Spielraum, den ihm diese Macht für sein freies Handeln lässt. Die Frage nach der Willensfreiheit also. Und zweitens die Frage nach der Zukunft, die unbekannt, dunkel und bedrohlich vor ihm liegt. Translated, at first the question about the leeway that this divine power conceded to every human being to act and decide freely, that was the question of the freedom of the will. And secondly, the question of the future, how obscure, predictable or changeable it was thought to be. Translation ends. So, how free are my decisions and actions, respectively, how strong are they bound to a higher power's will or plan? Can I predict, influence, or change these plans? Such questions are the basis of my research project, and of course, these questions already existed before the Middle Ages. The ancient Greeks, for instance, gave several names to fate. Moira, Tyche, Haimamene, Ananke, Fatum in Latin, mainly depending on the degree of abstractness, respectively personalization, of this deity. Albrecht Diele knows no less than three different traditions of thought regarding the question of human independence or determinism. Plato and the Platonism, respectively Neoplatonism, the Aristotelian point of view, and the Stoa. All of them awarded more or less power to fate over human life. Especially Plato confronted fate with another regulating and planning divine power, pronoia, in Latin, providentia. Beside these Greco-Roman traditions, there existed several others, but sadly we know much less about them. The ancient Germanic gentes seem to have believed that they were very strongly determined by the forces of fate. They regarded life as being chained to an unchangeable fate. Auspicia sortisque ut qui maxime observant. No people are more addicted to divination by omens and lots, Tacitus tells us in his famous Germania. And as the Roman historian Justinus writes, the Celts, being quite similar to the Germani regarding ritual issues, shall have outrun every other people in the art and observance of auspicia. In Ireland, the Celts are said to have fallen in trance intentionally by gluttony or fast, provoking visions of the future. The observance of birds played a crucial role as well. This seems to have been mainly the business of the intellectual and cultural elite, the Druids. Christian authors rejected such thoughts of an independent, powerful force of fate. Especially in his relevant work, De Libero Arbitrio, about the free will, Augustine of Hippo proclaimed the free will of men. Only those were meant to find their way to God who voluntarily did good. But monotheism and the idea of a personal God intensified the contradiction between the providentia dei and the postulation of the free will. Generally, one has to bear in mind the different concept of freedom in medieval times, a concept derived from St. Augustine. Contrary to the ancient world and to modern times, where freedom means negative freedom, freedom from something, medieval freedom meant positive freedom, freedom for something else. Freedom as freedom for a total dependence on God and his will. The recent appraisal of the Augustinian works couldn't be more controversial. For some, Augustine is the inventor of the free will, having surpassed the pagan fatalism. Others criticize, mainly on the basis of his later works like the Quaestiones ad Simplicianum, Augustine wouldn't have declared mankind much more than God's puppets. Especially as Kurt Flasch accentuates it, because Augustine revoked his earlier divine theory of mercy in his Questions to Simplician. He revoked the freedom of men to do good and receiving God's mercy for that. As Augustine explained it to Simplician, God had decided to condemn, reprobare, or to salvage, providere, a man's soul before his birth, and the Lord would do that independently from the man's actions and decisions. For the 9th century, the heated controversy between Gottschalk of Orbain, with his understanding of a twofold divine predestination, providentia and reprobatio, Hincmar of Reims, Rabanus Maurus, and last but not least, the Irishman John Scotius Eriogena, must be mentioned. For Kurt Flasch, this quarrel was not a struggle between differing ideologies, but just one between those who had read Augustine carefully, Gottschalk, and those who had not. Nevertheless, for the Middle Ages, this controversy remained the exception rather than the rule. To date, we know several statements from the late antiquity about the issue discussed here. Besides the Augustinian works, the Etymologies of Isidore of Seville, the writings of Origen, Boethius or Gregory of Nyssa should be given as examples. But after them, these issues seem to have been discussed again in a theoretical manner only in the 12th and 13th century, like Thomas Aquinas did in his Summa Theologiae or Albertus Magnus in De Fato. The reason for this resumption undoubtedly lies in the recent rediscovery of many ancient works, especially in the rediscovery of several Aristotelian works, written in Arabic as one result of the Crusades. But the gap regarding the issue of fate and freedom between the years about 700 and 1150 after Christ is difficult to overlook. Part 2. Because it's hard to believe that the questions emphasized by Franz Tinnefeld as more or less anthropological constants weren't raised in these almost 600 years of history, it is necessary to make use of other sources. Already in 1965, the canonist Pierre Legendre claimed to use canonical collections for answering questions of relevance for social history or the history of mentality. In fact, canonical collections do contain useful information about the issue discussed here. But of course, this information is not given in such an explicit way as the theoretical texts do. The subject opens up here from a normative point of view. Canon law is mostly seen as the reaction of Mother Church to the offenses of her daughters and sons. So these norms are frequently taken as a mirror of reality, which is quite problematic in some ways. More on this in a moment. On the one hand, I analyze what could be called implicit statements or meta information concerning the relationship between men in a more or less marked out individual salvatory way. For instance, acts of penance that could alter the sinner's way into hell, could shorten the time in purgatory, or ordeals showing immediate divine influence in human life. Largely leaving aside positively received ways of caring for salvation, like pilgrimage, on the other hand, I focus on sanctioned practices and ideas in the context of decoding or influencing fate and future. I mean contraventions that were frequently carried out with the help of dark powers and were subsumed under the term superstitiones. Dieter Hamening collected and classified several kinds of superstitiones, and in general used mainly theological writings for that manner, but some canonical collections as well. He formulates a double warning. At first, all these texts should not be used as mirrors of a current historical reality, he says. Much more important was the fact that these texts passed on ancient, mainly Mediterranean practices, in a more or less literary manner. Especially important were works like the Sermons of Caesarius, Archbishop of Arles, from about 505 until his death in 542. And secondly, Hamening keeps it as soon as ascertainable topos, that every superstitio was marked as a very old and pagan relic. So the prescriptions of the canons alone do not give enough evidence, neither for regarding their content as a report of the current situation, nor for regarding the described superstitiones as an ancient pre-Christian leftover. But they actually can give evidence for that in conjunction with other sources. In my opinion, this is a very important warning. Nevertheless, to a certain extent, Hamening seems to neglect the special process of compiling medieval canonical collections, obviously because he did not use canonical collections as his main sources. Usually, the canonists didn't create their own texts using their own words, but they collected and arranged existing material. So if they wanted to adapt their material to the current situation, it was mainly achieved by selection, rearrangement, abridgment, or sometimes interpolation of the sources rather than by writing new texts. Under the given circumstances, I chose the following procedure. In the first place, I try to find and to appraise the relevant information in the chosen canonical collection, asking myself, what kind of superstitiones are described? What do the texts tell about human relationship to freedom, respectively determinism? On this basis, a comparison on several levels seems promising to me. At first, a comparison of the relevant passages with the evidently used sources. How were these sources used? Which passages were adopted, which not? Are there differences, changes, rearrangements, interpolations, and why? One main issue here is the question if the compilers worked intentionally, and what kind of intentions they could have had, or if they just copied a source word after word just because of its great authority. Second, a comparison with other important canonical collections that were evidently not used as a source, although they might have already been at hand. What could have been the reason to leave these texts out? Why could the compilers of these other collections have solved certain problems either in the same or maybe in an entirely different way? Third, a comparison with other kind of sources, historiographical, hagiographical texts, secular law, and others. Are my results actually just topoi, and do they fit into a wider frame of contemporary discourses? For instance, the pseudo-Isidurian forgeries cannot be analyzed with regard to the special questions discussed here without bearing in mind the aforesaid quarrel about the writings of Gottschalk of Orbais. And fourth, a comparison of all the relevant results after having investigated all of my selected canonical collections. Are there discernible developments or changes over the centuries? Having done this, I hope to show a network of references, adoptions, and citations. The changes that were made could not only increase the understanding of the canon's literal contents, I also hope to contribute to the answer of the great question how exactly canonical collections were compiled in several periods of the medieval age. As already mentioned, I will focus on several canonical collections that were of certain importance in their time between the 8th and the 12th century. These are, at first, the Collectio Hibernensis. I'll go deeper in that in a minute. Second, the Pseudo-Isidorian Decretals from the middle of the 9th century, one of the largest and most important forgeries of the whole Middle Ages, and next to the Collectio Dionysio Hadriana, one of the most important canonical collections of the Carolingian age. Third, the Decretum of Burchard of Worms, written in the early 11th century, one of the most eminent canonists of the Ottonian period, the late Ottonian period, who dedicated the whole Liber Decem of his work to magics and fortune telling. In his 19th book, called the Corrector, he deals with several offenses, including different superstitiones. And in book 20, called Speculator, Burchard negotiates issues like divine predestinatio et providentia. Fourth, the Panormia and Ivo of Chartres Decretum. Both closely related collections were attributed to Bishop Ivo of Chartres until the investigations of Christoph Rolke, and both are very important collections of the time of the so-called Gregorian Reform. And fifth, the Decretum Gratiani. I can't stress the great importance of this first universal canonical collection here. I'd just like to point out that large parts of this collection were still valid canon law until the year 1917. Magister Gratian dedicated a whole causa, causa 26, to the issues discussed in this context. I can't go without that. Part 3. The Collectio Canonum Hibernensis was probably compiled by the monks Reuben in the southern Irish monastery of Dairiness and a monk with the old Irish name Su Chuimne, in the northern Irish monastery of Iona, between 716 and 747. It is doubtless of Irish origin, although no manuscript of the collection has survived on this island. Its purpose was to harmonize contradictory legal sources as an introduction explains. Scholars have discerned a probably slightly older A version from a little bit more detailed B version. While A was edited by Hermann Wasserschleben in 1874, reworked in 1885, Roy Fletchner is just preparing an edition of the longer B version, which today, more than 150 years after the A version was printed, is still unpublished. I am very grateful to Mr. Fletchner that he sent me an extract of his manuscript. He took over his work from Daniel Anthony Binchy and Morris Sheehy, who both passed away before they could have finished it. This may explain why it takes so long to get the B version printed. But I am glad that when I met Roy Fletchner in 2014, he was a young man in a good state of health. There are two reasons why, for my purpose, the Hibernensis is of great interest. On the one hand, it is hardly possible to overestimate the influence of the early medieval church, the medieval Irish church, on the continent. I won't go further here than to point to the fundamental changes regarding penance. It was the Irish who introduced secret confession and private penance. Until that time, confession and penance were public acts of ritual self-humiliation. Manuscripts of the Hibernensis have been found as far as Benevento and Naples. On the other hand, early medieval Ireland is a fascinating special case. It underwent an early Christianization, according to legend, by St. Patrick in the 5th century. Its society carried the torch of a high degree of literacy, but the island was never conquered by the Romans and integrated into the Roman Empire. Therefore, Ireland was not Romanized like so many other regions, European regions were, and several Celtic or better Old Irish traditions and reminiscences survived. Their traces have also been found largely undisputed in the Hibernensis, mainly by Morris Sheehy. For example, regarding marriage, the Old Irish were notorious bigamists, the distribution of lands, the holding of hostages, and several other things. The sources of the Hibernensis have recently been investigated by Lunette Mair Davies. They consist of usual material for canonical collections, the Gallic Councils until the year 506, the Statuta Ecclesiasticae Antiqua, written in the years between 442 and 506, and the Collectio Dionysiana from the middle of the 6th century. But the compilers also used to a great extent material that never was used for canonical law collections before. Patristic writing, the works of the church fathers like Augustine, Gregory the Great, or Hieronymus, and the Bible, mainly the Old Testament. Recent scholars like Michael Gorman have accentuated how many false citations the compilers used. Quote, "It is the innumerable bogus citations which constitute the most curious feature of the Collectio Hibernensis." Although not of great length compared to other canonical collections, the Hibernensis contains three whole libri of relevant material for the issues discussed here. De Sorte, De Mortuis in Somno Visis, and De Auguriis. Even this alone is extraordinary compared to its sources, as well as to other collections like the Vetus Gallica or the much longer Collectio Hispana. I'll quickly go through these three books now. You can follow by looking at the screen if you like. The book De Sorte starts in its first chapter, De Sorte Mittenda in Incertis et Dubiis, with a pseudo-Bible code, when to cast lots. Sors inter paria mittitur et incerta, ut Deus in viso homini distinguat. In the case of equal arguments or uncertainties, God may judge in the face of men. Sors non aliquid mali est, sed res in dubitatione humana divinam nobis indicans voluntatem. Lots were no evil, but they would show divine will. This is underlined by no less than three Augustinian quotations. So from the very beginning, casting lots is highly valued in the Hibernensis. The second chapter joins in. In sorte non est electio, sed Dei voluntas. Lots are no election, God speaks by lots. De multis duos eligere nostrum est, Dei autem de duobus judicare. To select two out of many is human business. To select one out of two is divine will. Only the third chapter contains a warning. Sortis non semper mitendi sunt, quia aliquando fallunt. According to St. Augustine, lots sometimes fail. In the B version, a passage from a yet unknown source points out demons speak through lots. Still unpublished, so not on your screen here. But this gets immediately moderated by several examples for failing lots or, properly speaking, failing prophets. The quintessence, cum privilegia singulorum, non possint legem facere communem. You should never take single decisions for common law. The fourth chapter describes in detail and very specifically the areas where casting lots would be useful. To solve quarrels about lands, borders, and heritages. The distribution of posts, but definitely not to find the guilty in a crime case. Highlight and ending point of this book is the sixth chapter. An Irish synod is cited. Sors aut inter duo dubia, aut inter duo equalia, aut inter duo catholica miti debet. A lot should, or even must, debet, be cast between two doubtful things, or between two equal things, or between two Catholic things. No contemporary or older canonical collection deals with the question of casting lots in such a detailed way, and no contemporary or older canonical collection deals with the question of casting lots in such a positive way. Others only condemn augurii and sortilegi in the same breath and with much fewer words. De mortuis in somno visis, the dead that appear to the living, in book 51, according to the counting of Wasserschleben 51, would do that to warn and to console the living. Ali iputant angelicis operationibus sive ad vivorum, sive ad monendo. Yeah. And so on. Translated, some think that the dead appear by means of angelic graces, either in order to confront the living of their relatives, or in order to warn the human race that kindness be given to the grave. And although kindness does not assist the dead, it is nevertheless to blame if it's lacking in religiosity. It's again the third chapter that points out, aliquando visis fallacibus hominis mituntur in magnus erroris et reliqua. Every now and again, men fall into great errors by false visions. Care should be taken. Big errors could occur. The fourth chapter, quoting Gregory the Great from a yet unknown source, substantiates the reason for such a phenomenon. The dead uncover the future, witness the existence of heaven and hell, the final destination for all men. And again, the sixth chapter gives specific advice. Citing the Dialogi of Gregory the Great, the Hibernensis explains considerably detailed how to get into the proper state of susceptibility for visions, for instance, by gluttony or fast, plenitudine ventris aliquando in anitate. Besides that, several examples for problematic visions, like visions caused by enemies, are counted and, as if by way of compensation, positive examples for prophecies. Sancti inviri inter inclusionis ad querelevationes, nes ipsas visionum voces aut imagines quodam intimo sapore discernunt, ut siant qui ab bono spiritu percipiant, vel quid ab illusione patientur. The crucial point was to know the stimuli that caused the visions. The holy man would be able to do that properly. But the dead don't appear here in this sixth chapter. It's all about visions in general. This book is as unique as the former. Nowhere else the interpretation of dreams and the confrontation with dead people is an issue at all. And again, it works, but you should be careful when doing this. The book De Auguriis seems to be the most conventional of all the three mentioned here. The first five chapters condemn magics, fortune-telling and prophecies, and impose these contraventions with ecclesiastical penalties. Here two canons of the Councils of Acte from 506 and Ankara from 314 are cited. That's classical material for canonical collections. But again, the chapters 6 and 7 could be read as a kind of relativization. Quid faciamus si auguria ipsa vera adnunciant? De hac re scriptura nos contestatur et admonit dicens, etiam si vera dixerint, nolite credere eis. What's to do, St. Augustine asks, if auguria should actually tell the truth? Even then, knowing that they were true, you shall not believe them, nolite credere, even if reality proves them. Fortune-telling meant communication with demons. That's not explicitly told here, but was common conviction. The seventh chapter quotes no one else than Isidore of Seville to explain why demons were in fact wiser than men. Demonis are grecis, dictos, aiunt, and so on. They say demons are so called by the Greeks as if the word were demnas, that is, knowledgeable in many things. Whence they are also accustomed to give some answers. And there is in them more knowledge of things than in fragile humanity, partly through the sharper acumen of their senses, partly through the experience of an extremely long life, partly through angelic revelation at God's command. So auguria could work, but a good Christian avoided them. That could be taken for the message of this book, and that's how chapter 8 closes this issue. According to St. Augustine, a good Christian wouldn't trust oracles, but bind himself entirely to God and place his trust in the sign of the cross, the creed, and the Lord's Prayer, especially in the face of difficulties. That's, in short, the Augustine definition of freedom. Auguria can actually work, but you shouldn't believe them. Nolite credere. Confidence in God makes even asking redundant. The whole making of the Hibernensis is nothing less than a drastic break with the usual ways to compile a canonical collection. Just 3 of the 38 citations in the 3 books mentioned here are canons from ecclesiastical councils, and there are no papal decretals at all. Most of the text was taken from patristic writings and the Bible. A quick look at the immediate sources that were used compiling the Collectio Hibernensis. The Statuta Ecclesiasticae Antiqua do contain material regarding the issue discussed here, the Canon 83. But the compilers of the Hibernensis did not use it at all, probably because of its reference to Jews. Insignificant for Irish business, no Jews in Ireland. From the canons of the Gallic councils, Canon 42 from the Council of Acte in 506 was used, but the Irish compilers left out the reference to the Sortes Sanctorum. These Sortes Sanctorum seem to have been practices or even writings of yet unknown nature, and as far as I can see it, they were unknown in Ireland. From the Collectio Dionysiana, they used Canon 23 of the Council of Ankara in 314, but again abridged. The reference to magicians who were invited into houses to clean them using their dark arts was dropped. Did this again happen intentionally? Was this custom alien to the Irish as well? To sum up, the approach to use canonical collections for answering questions like the above mentioned seems quite promising. Thank you. I cannot go deeper into a comparison with the other sources of the Hibernensis here, but there are many reasons to believe that the Hibernensis was intentionally well-directed and tailored to specific Irish conditions. The general use of patristic writings and the Bible for compiling a collection of ecclesiastical law was absolutely unique in those times. Obviously, better answers were found there. And if not, they had to be invented. This and also the specific use of the canonistic sources give evidence for a distinctive personal contribution by the compilers. Dealing with superstitiones takes up much more room than it does in any other contemporary or older canonical collection. The issue seems to have had much greater social relevance. The belief in the possibility of investigating the forces of fate seems to have been of greater significance. The opportunities and boundaries of human choice are clearly set. To choose 2 out of many, that's human freedom of choice. But to choose 1 out of 2, that's only God's will. In sorte non est electio sed Dei voluntas. The acceptance of problematic prophetic practices like necromancy or the interpretation of dreams appears to be greater than anywhere else, possibly because of their higher social relevance. On this basis, and after having checked some other kind of sources, until today mainly hagiographical writings and the Irish penitentials, I think it's quite likely that several pagan, pre-Christian elements regarding the issue discussed here could have survived until the 8th century and challenged the compilers of the Hibernensis. These compilers found their own way to deal with them. People seem to have been convicted that auguria worked. Prognostication by communicating with demons, independent from divine influence, was obviously possible. What does this tell about the mentioned tension? If the future seems to be widely determined by God, but its investigation seems to be possible even against God's will. Noli te credere, you shall not believe. Thank you for your attention.